This podcast was recorded Thursday, September 29th at 10:33 a.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this.
Yeah, like Mike DeWine will agree to debate someone about anything, anything at all.
Roger Maris versus Aaron Judge versus Barry Bonds, maybe?
I'm not sure if he could settle that one.
I don't know.
Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and those snollygosters or shrewd politicians who are flooding your TV screens with ads right now. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson. Coming up in the podcast, it turns out there will be debates, two of them, both in the U.S. Senate race.
But first, we will take a step back from the day-to-day news of the campaigns and look at the actual process of voting, you know, the task that all this fuss is about.
Yeah, we often forget that this stuff is designed to get people to cast a ballot for a certain candidate or cause. And as we have learned and seen on bright displays since, really, Bush v. Gore in 2000, the process of voting varies across the country. And the system of picking our national, state, and local leaders is far from perfect and can be manipulated by snollygosters.
I'm shocked to hear that. The latest cost of voting study is out, and it ranks all 50 states based on what it calls the overall investment that a resident must make in terms of time and resources in order to vote.
They focus on 10 categories, including registration, inconvenience, early voting, polling hours, absentee voting.
A lot to consider there. And according to the study, Oregon and Washington, which both vote entirely by mail, rank first and second. Mississippi and New Hampshire rank 49th and 50th. As for where Ohio ranks in the study, we are at number 41 in the bottom 10.
Wow. So to give us the story behind these rankings, we turn to Michael Pomonte. He is a former university professor and an expert in voting access. He is a co-author of the study. Michael, welcome to Snollygoster.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Mike. Thank you for having me.
Great. Let's start with the big picture. If you look at the entire country, what is the cost of voting? Is it too high, too low?
Well, the cost of voting that citizens bear really varies depending on the state, right? Like you said in your introduction, Oregon and Washington, those voters get to stay home on election day. And when the state has the ballots ready, they're mailed out to those citizens well in advance of election day, compared to a state like New Hampshire that requires almost all citizens to go to the polling locations on election day. There is a significant variation. So we can't say it's easy or difficult because there is just so much variation among the 50 states.
Well, let's start with the states that did really well in your rankings. Again, Oregon, Washington, Vermont, and Hawaii. You mentioned Oregon and Washington as being really good at having mail-in ballots and voting from home. Is there anything else that these top-performing states have in common? Is there any other reason why they're so high in your rankings?
Absolutely. So if we actually look at the top eight states, they all have some form of automatic voter registration and all-mail voting. So with those two policies in place, all those citizens have it really, convenient as far as casting a ballot. And that's why we see individuals in those states or turnout in those states to be exceptionally high.
You know, Mississippi and New Hampshire, they don't have a whole lot in common, I think it's safe to say, but they are at the bottom of your rankings, just worse than Texas, Wisconsin, and Arkansas. Let's look at the bottom performers. What do those states have in common that ranks them so low?
Right. So typically, the states at the bottom of the ranking, they typically have registration deadlines that are further out from election day. You know, for example, in Ohio, you guys have a 30-day registration deadline. That is not uncommon for the other states at the bottom of the list. They also tend to lack early voting or require excuses to vote absentee. You know, some of these states may have one or two of these laws, but when we look at all the states combined, they really have fallen behind the adoption of new laws and take advantage of new technology that removes barriers for citizens to cast their ballot.
Let's look at Ohio a little bit here. We've mentioned a few things about Ohio, namely our voting early and our registration deadline. We have early in-person voting, like we said. We have no excuse voting by mail. You can register to vote right up until early voting starts, which is the 30-day window. State officials, mainly Republicans, say it's pretty easy to vote here. Your study says differently. Why is this? I mean, I don't. Can you talk about, is it mainly, we often hear Democrats saying Republicans want it to be harder to vote, that favors them. Do you lean that way? And do you have any other explanations for why states like Ohio make it harder to vote?
Right. So as far as, you know, how citizens feel about whether or not it's easier or hard to vote in the state, you know, citizens may feel that it is absolutely easy for them to cast a ballot come, you know, election time. But the study is about the relative difficulty, right? So this is telling us that there's 40 other states where the voting is relatively easier than Ohio. I'm not saying, you know, it's hard in Ohio. I'm just saying that it's easier in those 40 other states.
You mentioned the, let's talk about this early in-person voting. You don't give Ohio any credit for our early in-person voting because we only have one spot per county. But that's still better than states that have no early in-person voting. Did you consider giving Ohio, you know, half credit, third credit to get our ranking up a little higher?
Absolutely. So we actually, there are two different things that a lot of people tend to get confused with our index and the differences between early voting and in-person absentee voting. They tend to look a lot alike, but there are some variations between those two different laws, right? Early voting tends to have more numerous locations that are set up longer than in-person absentee. And so we do give credit to Ohio for that in-person absentee. But, you know, when I'm doing this study, I'm not playing favorites. I'm simply tallying the laws that each state has and whether or not it fits our definition for each specific categorization that we are specifically looking at.
Yeah, and to be honest, it is difficult, even though we do have early in-person voting. But if you don't have a car and you live quite a while from your county's Board of Election headquarters, or you live in a rural county and it's a long drive to get there, it's not easy to vote early. So if you had more than one location, it certainly would make it easier. And other states do have that. So you can see how Ohio would rank lower than
those. For me, living in the middle of nowhere, it's about a 20-minute drive to my county Board of Elections. And, you know, I'm blessed to have a couple running vehicles. But, yeah, certainly for people who do not, it's quite an obstacle. Michael, we have not yet talked about one of the most divisive parts of voting restrictions, and that would be voter ID laws. Where does Ohio come down in terms of voter ID laws compared to other states?
So Ohio has what we classify as a strict non-photo ID. So this means that voters are required to show some sort of identification. It doesn't have a photo on it, but if they do not present that type of identification, they are given what is called a provisional ballot. And that provisional ballot is not actually counted until they come back and present the appropriate ID to their voting location or their county clerk's office. So that is, it's definitely an inconvenience, but it is not nearly as bad as, let's say, a strict photo ID policy where states specifically require certain identification with certain photos in it before casting and counting your ballot.
Yeah, I was telling Mike that I will occasionally, when I go vote, I often take a utility bill with me. And when the person at the polls asks for ID, I give them a utility bill. And I've had them ask, well, don't you have a photo ID? And I say, well, I prefer to use this. It's just my way of testing them. And I have had some confused poll workers who did not really press the issue, but I don't think they were fully aware. I don't know how they just didn't seem like they'd ever encountered that.
Yeah, they, you know, because the poll workers work once, twice a year maybe. And
most people just pull out a photo ID. It's the easiest form of ID they can provide.
Talking about restrictions, you know, Georgia, Wisconsin, Connecticut recently have all put added restrictions on voting. How did that play into your rankings? And were there a lot of shifts from last year to this year, from 2020 or 2019 to this year?
Yeah, so we actually see shifts between elections every time we calculate our new cost of voting index. And this is primarily due to some states passing restrictive laws and other states passing laws that remove barriers. So some states that perhaps don't change any of their laws could see a change in their ranking depending on what the states around them in the rankings do over the next 2 years. And that's why we emphasize that this is a relative ease or relative difficulty of voting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one person's voting restriction is another person's voter suppression, but to another person, it's protection against fraud. I suppose there's no real balance to be had here, right? This is a very subjective thing on whether you think that this is voter suppression or voter protection.
Well, that wasn't really the topic of this study. However, I do have a book coming out early next year that dives into this topic in depth. And just to kind of give you a preview is voter fraud is very rare, right? Regardless of how we look at it and when we look at it across the states. So a lot of these laws don't do anything as far as increasing or reducing the instances of fraud.
Yeah, there are like 30 possible cases of fraud in 2020 out of, 5 million votes cast?
Yeah, after every election, we read the numbers, and it's usually like 1/100,000th of 1% of ballots cast were identified as possibly fraud.
Yeah. I mean, they weren't.
Possibly.
They were referred to prosecutors to look into, and I don't think we've had many cases at all, maybe one or two.
Yeah.
What do you hope this ranking does? What's the main goal of publishing this list every year, every 2 years?
Right. So our goal with this is to make it simple to understand how changes in voting laws impact the overall access to the ballot for voters and to identify which states are reducing the cost of voting for their constituents compared to other states.
Mm-hmm.
So we really want to know, or we really want to get out that, you know, especially towards the citizens that live in the states towards the bottom of our rankings, that, you know, the rest of the country, it has it relatively easier to cast a ballot than you, right? And this typically increases participation. And we know that when citizens increase their participation, government is more responsive to their citizens. So that is the ultimate goal of this research, is to increase citizen participation and increase the responsiveness of government to its citizens.
Michael, we are the United States of America, so everything is always going to be a little different state by state. But should national elections be administered nationally? Do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, it's you can't do anything with local elections, I don't really think. But for national office, should states follow the same rules and have the same standards?
Right. So in the Constitution actually gives the states the ability to set forth their own laws. So without an amendment, we'd be hard-pressed to change anything like that. However, the national government is allowed to pass some legislation that requires the states to follow specific guidelines. And, you know, we saw that in early 1993 under the Clinton administration when they passed the National Voter Registration Act, also known as Motor Voter, right? So the national government does have the ability to come in and say that there are minimum requirements that states need to meet in order for federal elections.
That seemed like a pretty easy one. Could constitutionally the federal government say you have to allow registration up to 1 week before election day? Could that be a guideline that would pass constitutional muster, do you believe?
Absolutely, because with the National Voter Registration Act, they actually outlawed registration deadlines in excess of 30 days. So the national government definitely has the ability to set forth those guidelines and make states abide by those for national elections. States can go ahead and make different requirements for their state and local elections, but for national elections, they do have to follow those guidelines set out by the federal government.
Yeah, and the argument against the national system is that if you had one system for the entire nation, it could be more easily hacked. But that's not what people are talking about. Each state and county would have their own system. They'd use their own machines. They have their own
nationwide rules,
their own local oversight. But there would be certain rules. You've got to register by this date. You have to have this kind of ID. You have to have early voting in 5 locations around your county.
Sounds like you should take that on, Mike.
Yeah, good luck.
Michael, what is the name of your book and when will it be out?
It is titled The Cost of Voting in the American States, and we're thinking it's going to be late first quarter of next year, so around March, April of next year.
Well, we'll look for that. Michael Pamonti is the co-author of the 2022 Cost of Voting Index study that ranks Ohio 41st out of the 50 states. Michael Pamonti, thanks again for joining Snollygoster.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Michael.
We'll be right back.
Support for WOSU podcasts comes from listeners. You can give at WOSU.org. Thank you for supporting digital content from WOSU Public Media.
Welcome back to Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media. After weeks of indecision, political jockeying, negotiations behind the scenes, Ohio's two candidates for U.S. Senate have agreed to debate twice next month.
Yep, Republican J.D. Vance, Democrat Tim Ryan, they'll debate in Cleveland and Youngstown. The Cleveland debate is set for Monday, October 10th at 7 o'clock in the evening. It'll be hosted by the local Fox affiliate in Cleveland. Plans for this debate are to have it air on Nexstar stations, that's a television company, in Dayton and Columbus.
And the Youngstown debate will happen a week later on Monday, October 17th, and it is sponsored by WFMJ-TV and will be aired locally.
Good news.
It is good news.
Yeah, I think...
I'm a little surprised, honestly.
Well, no, I thought these guys would debate maybe just at least once. They had to. They're so close. I mean, the latest poll out this week from Siena College and Spectrum News has Tim Ryan up by 3 points, which means they are still statistically tied. So they are going to need something to break through, and the debate might be it for one of these two candidates.
So the debates are definitely airing here in Columbus and in Youngstown?
That's to be seen. We don't know. I think we can safely assure the debate on Monday, October 10th, will be shown here in Columbus and Dayton.
Right.
Now, Cincinnati is not listed. I don't know if they have a Nexstar station in Cincinnati. Does Cincinnati get Dayton stations? I believe they do on their cable system, so Cincinnati likely will be able to see it. The FMJ-TV in Youngstown, the only thing I see now is that it will be aired locally. You know, we would love to air it on WOSU Radio, if possible. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the local TV stations here would like to air it. We'll have to see if it does. The time slots are good, though. Monday at 7 o'clock is a good time, except for those who watch, I forget if it's Jeopardy or Wheel at 7. But anyway.
I don't know.
I remember when Sherrod Brown debated Jim Renacci back in 2018, the debate was at like 8 o'clock on a Saturday night. I mean, come on.
That's almost as dumb as the Trump rally held during the Ohio State football game.
It was a good debate, but nobody was watching it. So.
You know who's from about halfway between Dayton and Cincinnati? J.D. Vance from Middletown, Ohio. I wonder if debates will be televised in Middletown.
Well, he's from Cincinnati. That's where he lives. I think that's where
he grew up in Middletown.
Now.
He grew up about halfway between Dayton and Cincinnati.
Yeah, I don't know where his current Ohio address is because he was in D.C. for a while, but he lived in Cincinnati for a while.
If you listen to the ads, it's in San Francisco.
Well, Tim Ryan's ads, that is.
This once again solidifies that Youngstown is really ground zero for this debate, and we've been saying this for some time now, and then I laughed when I saw that one of these debates is in Youngstown because Youngstown is a fine city. But it's getting so much attention in this race. So much attention.
Yeah, I mean, that's the key. It really is. That's who Tim Ryan is going for. The Mahoning Valley, the Northeast Ohio, working class, disenfranchised manufacturing workers.
You sound like Sherrod Brown right now.
They were left behind, listing all these counties, you know. Ashtabula, Summit.
Going to Youngstown, Gerard Warren.
But anyway, I mean, that's the voter that... They voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012. Then they voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020. Tim Ryan wants to get some of those folks back in his corner. That's really the only way he's going to be able to win. He has to, of course, keep Democrats in his corner, and that's the risk of going too far to the right, to African-Americans in Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati think they're being left behind by Tim Ryan's message. We'll have to see. But Youngstown is ground zero. I think on election night, we will be watching returns from Mahoning County very closely, and that could tell the story.
We've been singing the praises right now of these two, right, who are not snollygosters. They are agreeing to debate. That is not the case for Governor Mike DeWine. He has so far not done anything as far. He dodges the question when you ask him. He says that Ohio voters know me well, and so I think he's setting the table for just not debating Nan Whaley at all. That's what it seems like at this point.
Yeah, latest poll, that Siena poll, he's got more than a 20-point lead in this one, which is in line with the 15 to 18 points we've seen in several independent polls lately. The editorial boards at newspapers in Cleveland and Columbus and Cincinnati are hammering him for ducking debates with Nan Whaley. One even suggested he's refusing to debate the first woman nominee for governor in Ohio. And, you know, he deserves the criticism because, you know, candidates for governor should debate at least once.
Yeah, it's pretty lame. It's, you know, I've taken the position that if I was a DeWine advisor, I would advise him not to debate as well because I don't think anything politically good is going to come from it. But obviously, it's the moral thing to do. It helps voters know who you are, and I just think debates are such an enduring thing in our political process that they should be respected and that there should be at least one debate for the governor's race.
Yeah, I mean, Nan Whaley is not going to be, you know, touting conspiracy theories like some of these other candidates are doing. So he doesn't have to really answer any of that and fact check Nan Whaley, nor does she have to fact check him because he doesn't do these conspiracy theories. My guess is he's got a big lead. He doesn't want to get up on that stage and have to answer why he hasn't, after promising to tighten gun restrictions, why he was not able to do it. He doesn't want to have to explain his position on abortion rights. He'd love to talk about Intel, though. He probably doesn't want to talk about how he handled COVID either, which is, for most people, he gets high marks for. But for some of his base or the Republican base, he does not get high marks for. So maybe he just wants to avoid COVID, the abortion issue, the gun issue, and coast to reelection.
And the nuclear bailout, the biggest scandal in Ohio history.
That's true.
I mean, Nan Whaley would go to great lengths to hammer him on that, hammer him on guns, abortion, and it would just, nothing good would come of it for Mike DeWine. I mean, voters know him already. They have opinions formed on him, I think. But again, I think he should, just for the sake of not being a snollygoster.
I think it would be good. It'd be good for him, be good for the bottom line. It's good for the audience, good for the voters to hear both of them debate. Yeah. But it does not look like it's going to happen.
Yeah, that's great. That's enough talk about bipartisanship. Let's get on now to the snollygostering. It is time for our namesake award, the Snollygoster of the Week Award, the portion of the podcast where we honor the shrewdest politician or political move of the week.
This week it goes to the January 6th Commission. It was supposed to host what could have been, or could be, its final public hearing. It was supposed to host it on Wednesday, but the commission postponed it, saying it was not appropriate to hold this hearing as a major hurricane was coming ashore off the west coast of Florida.
That sounds nice when you hear it. Of course, had the commission held the hearing, it would have been overshadowed by the news, and the broadcast networks and the cable news channels likely would not have covered it live. When it comes to breaking news, reporters dangling from lampposts blowing in the wind will always trump congressional hearings, so even though congressional hearings are about Trump.
Yes. So whether it was to protect public safety or to protect its position in the news cycle, postponing its hearing earns the January 6th Commission our Snollygoster of the Week Award.
That is certainly their first time being the award winner there. If you have a suggestion for next week, you can send it to snollygoster@wosu.org. Also, be sure to leave us a good review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your podcast. Until next week, for our audio producer, Eric French, and our digital producer, Michael DeBonis, I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.